Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a joy to welcome Julia Baird. Hello.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello. Hello again, because we've already done one for Strawberry Fields, so hello again.
We did. What was the follow-up to that?
Excellent. I mean, really, I had never heard of the Egg Pod. We live in the countryside and I'm a bit not techie. Although I love it, I see all the advantages, you know, I just can't do things with it. I'd never heard of it. And we got a brilliant response from it, so thank you for that.
Oh, cool. Fantastic. So, first of all, one thing I must ask, have you been watching Get Back?
Do you know what? No. No. They sort of selected however many, is it 6.5 hours?
Oh, yeah, more like eight, yeah.
Eight hours out of about a million, didn't they, for? And to me, it would be like coming in the house and putting the answering machine on and hearing John talking to me. Mm. So I avoid it as, I just avoid it. It's not something I want. But I think obviously the rooftop Savile Row stuff was just beyond genius. Absolutely fantastic. And I understand completely why the fans would want to garner and glean every crumb of what went on before in the creation of that. I get it completely. Yeah. But it's really not for me. I love the actual performance, but I don't want to hear John chatting and laughing and not unexpectedly, I will put the television on like everybody else across the country and hear what they are hearing. It's just not for me. I'm sure you understand.
Oh, of course, yeah. So, talking of Get Back, one thing I notice online and on comments on iPod, fans of all ages have been just totally enamoured by this Get Back thing. And also they're fascinated by all the sort of non-Beatle people like Mal Evans and Glyn Johns and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would definitely suggest, if anybody doesn't have it, your book, Imagine This, Growing Up With My Brother John Lennon, because it's like getting to know all his family or your family.
I suppose it's another thing of like the run-up, isn't it, to the Beatles, and then a bit about the establishment of the Beatles from the before the Quarrymen. But I understand what you're saying. It's there's the same build-up of characters and what meant to make John, Paul, George and Ringo, and obviously, in my case, John in particular, whereas Get Back, you would have had a good view of all four of them and satellite people that they couldn't operate without. They couldn't operate without.
Yeah. So let's go through some of my favourite bits anyway. I wouldn't say favourites. Okay. It's just an amazing, powerful book. But I think just for the benefit of the listeners, just a very brief family tree, just because there's a lot of you. There's a lot of you out there.
Yeah, we're a big family. My mother was one of five daughters. There had been two children previously, a boy and a girl, and they had both died, sadly. And they're buried in the grounds of Liverpool Cathedral, the Anglican Cathedral, along with the grandparents. And there were five girls, born 1906, 08, 11, 14, and 16. So a long, long time ago, isn't it? Because every time one of them would have a birthday, we always have a drink to that, obviously mother. So, yes, there were five girls, and the five girls between them had seven children.
Your grandparents, so there's Annie Jane Stanley and George Stanley, yeah. George known as Pop by everybody.
And I remember him vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, he seems from your book quite a formidable character.
Well, he was at sea for a long time. And he famously came back and left another baby behind. It was one of those, you know, that everyone in Liverpool is connected with the water in some way. I mean, I inquired about going into the Wrens. And I found out, I mean, just in acquiring careers at school, I found out that the women didn't even step on a ship. So that was out for a start. Yeah. But in Liverpool, everyone's got something to do in those days with the shipping industry, whether they're on the water or off. And when my grandfather took retirement, I think He was on the tugboats for a while, and then he was in shipping insurance in the Liverboats. And, you know, it was just a completely natural step for them.
Yeah. So, yeah, your aunts, again, just for the listeners, so you know who we're talking about. So there's Mary, also known as Mimi, Elizabeth, also known as Mater, Anne, also known as Nanny, Julia, who obviously we know. Sometimes she got called Judy, was that right?
She did, yeah. Not by us.
And then also Harriet, known as Harry.
Yes. Now, my mother was Judy to the other children of the seven, if you like. Yes. But you said also known as, so you're absolutely right. You've obviously done your homework. Mary became Mimi when Stan and Leela, the oldest of the seven, were born because it was easier to say.
Oh, really?
Some sort of affectionate name, but Mimi. Then Elizabeth, she was known to the sisters as Liz or even Betty. And then when Stan came along, when she had her son Stanley, he went to boarding school and started calling her Mater. And then we were all born later, so we all called her Mater. And that really, really, really stuck. But the sisters called her Liz or Betty, one or the other. Then there was Anne and Georgina after her father. And she got Anne or Annie. And that became Nanny very quickly. As people often thought, it was a grandmother, especially in Liverpool, it's a very common term for granny, grandma, nan, nanny. So everyone just thought she was our grandmother. Then my mother was obviously mummy to us, and then Judy to the other children. It was Judy, that was her shortened name. And then Harriet, that we went to live with after our mother died, became Harry. So they all had names and nicknames. For the children.
Yeah. I hope listeners are taking notes on this because we'll be testing you later.
I might get it wrong.
So, it's very difficult to keep track because there's so much moving around of houses.
You're right.
I mean, first of all, it's wartime. We have to sort of mention that. You forget in the Beatles story, as Beatles fans, it does start in the war.
They are war children. And we're slightly younger because John was 1940. In our section of the family, our little narrow band, there was John in 40, Victoria, who became Ingrid in 45, me in 47, and my sister Jackie in 49. So we were all in the 40s from the beginning to the end. So Don was an absolute war baby, as was Paul, as was Ringo. When was George born? You would know better.
43.
They're all war babies. And we were, it was like we were war babies because, you know, they talked about the war all the time, in the war and during the war. And of course, we were still Russian until I was rationing about 1953. It ended. I remember getting the bus to Penny Lane, which was our ration centre, because that's one of the houses. That's the house that I was born in and John was born from in Penny Lane. And my mother's ration books were there. And then when she had Jackie, we were in Springwood. We'd moved. And we had to go back to Penny Lane on the bus with the ration book. Got your bacon and your butter and your cheese and orange juice with the blue top. But our ration book was assigned to certain shops. Yeah. And they weren't near where we were living. They were in the opposite direction, back where my mother had lived, in fact, where I'd lived as well.
Yeah.
We're war babies. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go back to 9 Newcastle Road. There's a lot of Stanleys in that house at various times.
There are. They moved out. They lived in five various flats stroke houses in the town area. That's where my grandparents are buried, right in the graveyard of the Anglican Cathedral. That was their local parish church. And then the two children, the first two children, were also buried there. And they moved around, and each of the sisters, each of the five girls, was born in a different house, all surrounding the cathedral. And my cousin, Stan, he died a few years ago. He made a sort of family history and went to Ireland, went to North Wales, to the people who still live in the farmhouse in North Wales.
Oh, they're still there.
I met them. Yeah, I met my grandmother's sister. She was 102.
Wow.
And she was still lucid. She couldn't move around, but she was still very lucid. So that was quite amazing. This is all Stan, you know, really doing what research he could. In those days, no phone, no computer. He was going to churchyards, going to church records, exactly how people did these things beforehand. So he found these five houses. So I know that my mother was born in number 8 Head Street, which is no longer there. That house has come down, and it's a modern building. It's some sort of community centre. Lydia Ann Street, my aunt Nanny, was born there, and it's where I go to get my hair done. Don't look too closely, I haven't been for a long time. It's right at the end of Lydia Ann Street. Yeah. And then there was Huskisson Street, Berkeley Square, and Kent Square. And we went to these houses, and that was their stamping ground. That was where they were brought up, right in the centre of town. Just before the war, in 1939, they moved out to number 9 Newcastle Road. You got it right. And Dom was born, he was born in Oxford Street, and I was born in Sefton General. My sister was born in Sefton General, and my first home was the same as John's, Newcastle Road.
Because Pop seemed to be holding court here, because he wasn't too keen on Alf Lennon.
No, he wasn't. And, you know, they were married for a number of years before they had John. It wasn't as if they had to go and rush off and get married or anything like that. If you have children, you think, who are they marrying? Who are they going to devote their lives to forever and have their families with? And we're all the same. And in those days, the old, what does your father do? And what did your grandfather do? I mean, it was a joke, wasn't it? But really, I suppose the question was asked.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they definitely weren't keen on Alf because he was a blue coat boy. He was in the orphanage, residential. But his mother was still alive. She just had so many children. And then the father died and she just couldn't cope. Yeah. A lot of people could.
As you say, yeah, John, when he was born, basically, Alf didn't see him for years on end.
Mm. Because he went to see.
Your mother must have been so patient, because she did stick with it for a few years.
You don't have a choice, Chris, do you? In those days particularly. But when you've got a small baby, even now, in the more enlightened area, if you've got a baby and you're married, and don't forget he was sending her money through the Seamen's Mission, she got money as his wife with a son, and he was out in the Merchant Navy, she could keep herself. There was no stamping around saying, I'm not putting up with this. It was just life for so many people. And even today, it's like that with small children.
Yeah. Oh, it's awful.
And then he did disappear.
Yeah, the money stops.
Yes. Yeah.
She's stuffed.
Well, he'd gone AWOL. I still don't really know that story. He went AWOL. I've heard various things of he was in prison for something, he'd had a fight or something. Mm-hmm. Nothing outrageous, but I think there was a fight. And then I've heard other stories of he just disappeared altogether, or he had a job over there. Whatever it was, from my mother's side back in Liverpool, she went down one fortnight to get her money from the Seamen's Mission. They said there isn't any. They're looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's gone AWOL. And now, again, in those days, and the country was still in a war state, well, it was embarking on a war state, there was no money. And so my mother lived with Pop in that house, and they were living on his pension, his sea pension, yeah. They were living on that.
It's incredible.
With John. It is. And Mimi was still in the house at the time, and Nanny was still in the house at the time. Now, they would have all been chipping in. Mimi was, she trained to be a nurse and or was in training to be a nurse, and Nanny worked for the civil service.
Mimi, from what I've read from your book, did seem to stand up to Pop. She seemed to be one, the one that
they didn't have the best of relationships, I don't think, growing up. But then, you know, as I get older, I can look back and think, well, she was the eldest of five girls. Not girls, five children. And as each child came along, the eldest child would automatically have to take on some of the duties of childcare. I would imagine I wasn't there. I wasn't there. But I can't imagine it'd be easy to be the eldest of five.
Sounds to me like an incredibly matriarchal family. But I think,
yes, it was.
Because obviously Julia met the Welsh soldier in 1944, and the repercussions of that seem to change everything for her and her relationship with her sisters.
If you watch even programmes today, I saw one on children who have been adopted, not even drastic ones that have gone to Australia, you know, the things that we should, as a nation, should be so ashamed of. But it wouldn't happen now, but it did happen then. The mothers are in tears, older mothers, because those babies were torn from their arms. They didn't, most of them, I haven't got a number, of course, most of them didn't willingly say, oh, I'm having a baby, here you go. The parents took over, the grandparents took over, society took over, and they all took over. And there's this bewildered young mother. We don't know where the bewildered young men ran to, but they certainly weren't on hand the majority of the time, were they? Because no one knew what to do, and the children became the victims.
In your book, and I've seen interviews with you since, because this is Victoria, who was fostered under a new name, Ingrid, but you had an interview with the Liverpool Echo a few years ago. You were unaware of her.
I didn't know. Until 1986.
Have you met her since then? Because
yes.
You put a call out in your book.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. She turned up, spoken to her on the phone. We all have. We all spoke to her. My cousin David actually went to Hampshire. She doesn't live there now. Went to meet her. And Leela had said, the door is open. You can anytime. You can meet us all. You can meet one at a time. We'll come to you. It's entirely, entirely your call. Anyway, we were up putting a plaque up, heritage plaque. It was the blue plaque, I think it's heritage plaque. And Stan and I are up the ladder because Stan was the eldest of these seven, so he's doing it. And we're all going for a meal with Yoko afterwards in the town hall. It's a celebration of everything going on. Stan went up the ladder and I was a bit worried about him. And I sort of went up and I was just really behind him, you know, to make sure.
Yeah.
Okay. He turned around to sort of look round. You know, he's at the top of the ladder. And I said, I remember saying, oh, careful, Stan, careful. And he said, Julia, I think that's Ingrid. And I went, Ingrid? And then waited till we got down and I went out and I went up the road to talk to her. She was standing apart. She had a companion with her. And we had a hug. I was expecting somebody to look like Jackie, my sister. Jackie's much taller than I, or a fair bit taller than I. But we looked the same. And John, despite the fact that we only shared a mother, the liking is quite striking. And here was somebody, fair hair, blue eyes. I wouldn't have known her. Maybe she looks like her father. Mm. Anyway, I said, come with us. We've got to go. We've got Oz there. Come with us. Both of you, come with us. And we can talk. If we'd have got to the town hall, I'd have got Jackie and we'd have gone somewhere and just said, let's just talk. Everyone will understand. Come with us. And she wouldn't come. Her companion said, let's go. And she said no and just walked off up the road. And everyone was back at Mendip's gates waiting to get in taxis to go to the town hall for a set meal that had been prepared. Mm. So we just didn't know what to do. But I did phone her after that, and we had the first conversation we had was about 4 hours, 3 hours, and I told her as much as I possibly could. And I told her for sure she was one of those babies that was wrenched out of our mother's arms.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, for sure. My mother, I think now, looking back, had postnatal depression from what Nanny told me. It wasn't plain sailing, believe me.
Mm. And there wasn't much support, I'm guessing, around at the time.
No. And I put a thing in the book saying, and the rest of my mother's life was dictated by the no baby.
Mm.
She carried that baby in her heart.
Wow. Yeah.
Victoria's, Ingrid's father, said he would have my mother even married before Alf came back. Didn't want Dom. So that was the end of that for him.
Yeah.
Having my mother and the baby. This is when she was pregnant. So that was the end. That was the end. Dom, Dom, Dom.
Yeah.
Leaving the family with the problem of definitely having a baby and the father's gone. He did make one little step forward. This is what many people are like, isn't it? It's not unusual.
My son, you're everything to me. My son, you're all I hoped you'd be.
So at this point, Julia, any money that she can get, as you say, was Pop's pension. So she started working in a cafe, where she met your father.
Well, before that, she worked in the picture house, the ABC, I think it was, at the top of the road,
yeah,
as an usherette, because Stan and Leela and John used to go in. I mean, obviously, I wasn't even born. Used to go in and be able to see all the films with, you know, for free. So that was the first job. And then she got a job in Brookhouse in Penny Lane, which is a cafe restaurant. And she met my father there.
John Dykins, also known as Bobby, and you've got a theory why he might have been renamed.
Well, my mother renamed him Bobby because she already had a John, my John. That's my mother's words, my John.
Yeah.
And then my father came along and said, yeah, John's part of the package. And I grew up with that. John was part of the deal. There's never any question about that.
Yeah.
So he was a bit forward thinking in that way.
Very much.
If you wanted my mother, then her son came.
Yeah, it's looking positive now, because he sounds such a gentleman as well. You know, he's taking on a woman and a child, and he was surrounded by a very forceful family.
Yeah.
You know, he sounds great.
Well, he faced up to Pop. He really faced up to Pop. Also, during the war, he had access to a lot of things because he was in the catering and hotel trade. I think that would have helped, but he definitely faced up to my grandfather. There's no doubt about it. And not many people have the strength to do that.
Mm. And it's at around this point when Alf turns up out of the blue and effectively kidnaps John. And Bobby is instrumental in getting him back as well, isn't he, with your mother?
I know, but look at, you know, as I said, as I get older, even from writing the book, I look back and I think, how did they do that? How did they cope? How did they get through this? And there's Alf, who had not had the best parenting himself, who in his head, no matter what the reason, in an orphanage, he and Edith, two of them, out of the, I think, six children, I think, the other stayed at home with their mother. And he knew who his mother was. He visited and she visited, but he was living somewhere else. I mean, this actual theme is repeated again and again. It's like a worn out record that won't go away. And he did have a son and he had a wife.
So, yeah, so as you say, yeah, they've moved back in with Pop, and Julian's now pregnant with you. And the reaction was, again, very much of its time, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. It was. They weren't happy because she was never divorced, because Alf wouldn't do it. And of course, the law was totally, completely, absolutely 1,000,000% on the men's side until about 1970s. And then divorces were happening one a minute once you could have irreconcilable differences. And what was the woman that actually, well, women were going in their droves, weren't they, to instigate divorces once they were allowed to. So, yep, she was married. She had John. She'd had Victoria. And then she was having me. For the family and society, it was like she was painting black brush all over her life. I can't imagine how she coped with any of it. Yeah. But then in that society, if I'm looking from a more mature point of view, the family had to cope with it as well in public life. And my very, very, very dearest best friend, her younger sister, is her niece. In that family, one of her older sisters had a baby and they adopted her. And so the youngest child was actually, my friend thought it was her sister until she was 16. They never realised that one of the older sisters who had four other children and visited a lot and was called Auntie whatever, was actually the youngest mother. So this happened a lot. It really did happen a lot. So, and then the family's left coping with it. I'm not so angst-ridden about it now. More, how did my mother cope in that atmosphere of that time, that condemnation? And where are the men? They're doing the condemning.
Yeah.
My attitude towards them hasn't changed much.
So obviously you've got hardly any money coming in, but Bobby's got this flat, which is very, very small. And it's too small, as it turns out, and Pop and Mimi between them do something horrendous, really, don't they?
Considering they'd always been at loggerheads. They actually got together over this John, over the whole John issue. Yeah, they went. They argued with my mother at first and my father, and then they brought a social worker who said everything was all right. Right, and then Mimi pointed out that there was only one bedroom, so they came back. And in front of my mother, they gave John to Mimi until they sorted themselves out, my parents. And I think it was in John's head. He knew, he was aware of everything that was going on. He was supposed to get up the next day and have his cornflakes.
Yeah, yeah. It's just otherworldly. You can't fathom any of this, really. It's just surreal. And I'm guessing the reaction was the same with Jackie, your sister Jackie, who was born, was it 2 years, 8 months after you?
Well, we had our own house then. My grandfather died and 9 Newcastle Road had been rented. I think the owner lived next door, or one owner owned number 9 and next door. I don't know which way it was. And he wanted to sell. And my grandfather had died and I think the family had the first refusal. No money. And so my mother and father and me, we went down to Springwood. But I'll just add in there that the John arrangement with Mimi was meant to be until my parents sorted things out.
Yes.
So they packed the flat in immediately and went back to live with Pop in Penny Lane, where Don had his bedroom. And Mimi pushed my mother out of the house and said, "You're not having him." And my cousin, Leela, was a witness to that. She told me. So they moved, they packed the house flat in straight away and moved back to the house. And there's John's bedroom. And so we now move down to Springwood in the August, September of 1949. My mother was heavily pregnant and I was 2. I remember the day we moved. I remember it clearly. I remember my sister coming home. She was due in December and born in October. So she was in the hospital.
She was tiny, wasn't she?
It was a premature miniature. Stan had been the same with a different sister. Stan was born at 1.5 pounds and my sister might have been knocking on 2 pounds, but they were both intrepid babies who survived.
And went on to get even taller than you.
Well, she got all those vitamins to keep her going. That's my story. Yeah. So, yes, we moved there. And again, there was a room for John.
That's what I don't Mimi understand. Had. Yeah.
No. But, well.
And also, Mimi wouldn't tell John where any of you were.
No, 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 she didn't. She didn't. She actually said to John, "Your mother's gone away with that man, and I don't know where she is."
Wow.
Absolutely not the truth.
Wow.
Didn't last long, though.
And then, yeah, you mentioned him already, Super Stanley comes to save the day.
Yeah, Super Stan. His mother had remarried and moved to Edinburgh, and Stan came down when he was 16 in the holiday with strict instructions, take that boy to his mother. Do it. So he did. So that was, I think it was probably a couple of months when John, as a child, didn't know where we were.
And when he did sneak round, he'd have to do it, you know, every now and again and not tell Mimi where he'd been.
No, he came a lot, and the people in the road opposite, still good friends, and their mother became a sort of mentor, very good athlete woman with a big, strong family, you know. And
is this the Starkey family?
Yes, it is. It is.
They sound amazing.
Oh, they are. They still are amazing. Believe me, they're absolutely amazing. And the parents have died. But when Hannah, Mrs. Starkey, was at the end of her life, she was living with her daughter, Anne, one of the daughters. And I went to see them. I used to go and visit her. And we'd sit and eat chocolates. Say, "Well, Junior Lev, if there's anything you want to know, don't wait till I can't speak." So she would tell me all sorts of things. And my mother engaged with her straight away. And her two elder daughters, Rita and Pat, practically moved into our house. My mother taught Rita the piano. They were in awe of my mother, and my mother was in awe of their mother. So they became. But all the people in that street, that road, remember John. When I wrote the book, I was knocking on all the doors. "Oh, where have you been? Where have you been? Come in, come in, come in." "Yeah, we remember this. We remember this. Oh, we remember John." Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, people say, "Oh, he didn't see his mother till he was 16. Well, get real. Wake up. For heaven's sake, I've written the book now.
Inchworm, inchworm, measuring the marigold. You and your arithmetic, you'll probably go far."
I do love this bit. And I think you mentioned it before about how much you love Springwood, because there's so many, you're really great at writing sort of evocative childhood. You bring out the magic of childhood. You're talking about like picking blackberries, collecting all those golf balls by the golf course.
Yeah.
And it's just silly things like that, you know. And I love the one where you were saying Julia peeling potatoes and teaching you the times table.
Times table. And John took that, you know, 1, 2, 3, 2, 6. In school in those days, we never said 2, 4, 6, 8. You ask a modern child their tables, 2, 4, 6, 8. And I say, "Oh, an easy one, hey. Let's do 7. 7, 14. I said, "Should we start again? Let's go back to 2 and let's do it in a completely different way." I don't know why they taught for a while. They were just teaching, just no context to it.
Yeah.
So, yes. So we did up to 16. I did up to 16 with my mother when I was very, very young. And John used to shout out, 7, 8. And he's like, 56.
I'm going to be testing you throughout this interview.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Three times 16.
48.
Wow. Be prepared. There might be another one coming up. But yeah, it does sound lovely. You know, you've got seem to have very treasured memories from being there. There seems to be lots of music and dancing going on there.
Yeah, my mother was a woman ahead of her time. Like John was a young man ahead of his time. Out there and carried the steep pain, and we were aware of something. We were. But she was entertaining, utterly beautiful. And of course, I relate all my life in Springwood with still having my mother and my father. So, of course, I put a wonderful gloss on it, haven't I? Because that was our family home before life changed in the blink of an eye. Yes, I was very happy there. And I have tried to evoke our childhood and the childhoods of all the children You know, we had our own hierarchy. We had our own rules and regulations. We probably obeyed Anne Starkey more than we did our mother, you know, because what Anne said, you just did it. Fortunately, she was a really nice girl still. Didn't tell you to do anything awful. But we went out for entire days with food and water. And Anne was in charge of it. She was about nine. And my mother would say, oh, you're going up to the valley, the field, you know, which was a walk and over roads and things. And she'd just put Ducky's coat on and say, hey. And I was given Jackie's hand. And I would give Ducky to Anne. She was the youngest. And she just came with us. It was just, we were not quite the Butcher Street kids, but we had a life of our own, completely outside our parents' window. But we were always back before we were dark, before it was dark, and to eat. But I don't think any parent or many parents were sitting on their children the way they do now. Don't know about your own childhood, but mine is quite similar to lots that I have read. We were in no way neglected or dirty when we left the house in the morning or anything like that. We were spanking clean, didn't last long. Well fed, all of us, always, always well fed. We would learn to read before we went to school, learn to write before we went to school, learned our tables as we were going to school. But free time was free time.
Yeah. Didn't your mother once go into school and tell them that you were too advanced for the ABC?
Yes, 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 she did. In the reception class, you know, at the F. And I was already writing far more than my name and things like that. And we'd made a book about cats. And my mother had done it as she did everything, as John later did everything, on crisp white paper and black calligraphic pen. Wait one second.
Ooh.
There's the pen. That's my mother's pen.
No way, that is beautiful.
That's my mother's pen. And wow. I've got the ink bottle. And John had it for a while. He left it with David Ashton, who died, went to one of the good friends who went to live in Denmark. And he knew he was dying. He had a cancer. And he parceled it up and sent it to me and said, I've been looking after your mummy's pen for you all these years. But wow. John gave it to him. So that's the pen.
That's beautiful.
So she came in with the book, and it was tied with red knitting wool with a big bow. And she said, this is what Julia's done. She knows the ABC. So then I was given books to read, and will you send her in the books?
Sweet 16 goes to church just to see the boys. Laughs and screams and giggles at every little noise. Turns her face a little, then turns her head a while. But everybody knows she's only putting on the style.
She's putting on the agony, putting on the style. That's what all the young folks are doing all of.
Again, yes, yeah, we sent lots of music and dancing. A key thing, Julia playing the banjo. And I mean, John's visits are obviously, I'm guessing, the older he gets, he's getting sneaking away a bit more. But she effectively taught him how to play music.
She did. She did. Yeah, she taught him the banjo first. Yeah. There was That'll Be the Day, and, you know, the Lonnie Donegan and Bill Haley and Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran. They were all, these names were flying around. And she was teaching him how to play the banjo. Yeah. And my mother played the piano, accordion, the ukulele, and the piano as well.
I love the story you're saying about when she used to play piano, she used to do the backing to Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
If you go down to the woods today, it was a bit of a nutcase, but in the nicest way.
Yeah. Skiffle, obviously, is emerging around this time in rock and roll.
Yeah, Lonnie Donegan, yeah.
Yeah, and you're saying like John's first ever group consisted of Julia and John.
But do you know what? You're right. You're absolutely right. The burgeoning Beatles, I suppose, the embryonic Beatles. And then when you think that Paul was living about 3/4 of a mile away, and he was twanging around on the piano and the guitar, and the Beatles were sort of born from John and Paul.
Yeah.
When they got to the actual band itself. But Jim, Paul's father, had been helping him because he played the piano. And my mother was helping John. They were both being helped along by the parents. I was just looking, I called them a name. What was it? The Dream Team.
Mm.
That's it. That's certainly what they were. They were writing and lyrics and poetry between them.
Yeah. So around this point, John starts forming a proper band, the Quarrymen.
Yes.
I'm just interesting also, because I remember before Imagine This, you did a prior book with Jeffrey Giuliano.
Yeah, I did.
Because I remember watching Wogan. I remember seeing you on Wogan talking about it. And the thing at the time...
I remember doing it, yeah.
How was Tortell? Was he good?
He was very nice, very accommodating and very kind.
Yeah. But there was talk at the time, because obviously the Goldman book was out and everyone was saying, oh, people are just ripping off, you know, John's name or whatever. But yeah. I was interested that you chose to work with Giuliano, because he's... not that respected within Beatles.
No. I know exactly what you're saying. I didn't know. I wanted the story out. And 5 years after John had died, if we're jumping forward here, but this is relevant to what you've just asked, there was a BBC Panorama programme on about commemorating John's death, really. And I said to the older children, because they're at school, teenagers, I said, well, you know, they wanted to watch it because everyone in school would have watched it. And I was keeping a very low profile where I lived and hadn't told anyone about John. I moved there in 1980. This programme came on in 1985 and it was so wrong, so misinformed, I couldn't believe it. So the next day, guess what? I rang the BBC and guess what? A human being answered the phone.
Wow.
Wouldn't happen now, would it? And I got through to the programme producer. And he said, well, you know, he said to me, what do you want? And I said, well, I'm John's sister. And he immediately jumped in and said, John doesn't have any sisters.
Wow.
I said, oh, he does. Oh, he does. I said, he's got two. He's got me and a younger sister. No, we have done thorough research.
No way.
Really, that's what we had to listen to. And the programme itself was as wrong as that all the way through. So I handwrote with a calligraphic pen, just like my mother, on white paper. I wrote a story and printed off 500 of these books with a friend who worked for a printing company. I collated it myself with help, did it all, over a room floor in my house, used the photographs and went to Beatle Week with it. Was at a little table. I mean, this is a new world to me. I'd never intended to do it, but I had to put that right. Yeah. I absolutely had to put it right. Otherwise, what are we? Dead? Not born? What's going on here? How can you do that to my mother? So he came and spoke to me, and it wasn't him that I did it for. He had two publishers who'd just come over from Canada, Carolyn Brenton and Lucinda Vardy. And they were a delightful, delightful couple. And I went to meet them in London. He'd gone back to New York. I went to meet them in London and they said, we can do this story for you. So that's how I ended up with him. But then once the book was done, that was all over. He tried to... link in a few times. I just said, absolutely nothing. It, you know, wasn't good. But I did it because of the publishers. They were absolutely delightful. Really, I trusted them completely. And they were the ones that got really peed off with him.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, digress.
Maggie, Maggie, May, they have taken her Robin, the homeward bounder. You dirty Robin, no good, Maggie May.
Again, Springwood, you've now got the Quarrymen rehearsing there. Tell me about your memories of that.
In the kitchen. Well, in the kitchen, because my mother not only didn't mind, she joined in. So the other one, Colin Hampton, the drummer, his mother would allow them to practice in their house on Saturday afternoon when she was out shopping. But my mother was waiting for them and took Rod Davis's banjo. And he said, well, where was your mother's banjo? He says that to me. I said, it was in my bedroom in the cupboard. But my grandfather, Papa, brought that from sea, and he taught my mother and my mother had taught John. So John was playing banjo chords for a time on the guitar.
Yeah, because you see those old photos, and I always try and count the strings. Did he only have four on his guitar? Did he?
Yeah. And then, of course, they didn't have microphones anywhere in the old school halls. So they played them as loud as they possibly could and broke strings all the time. And one of them would constantly be running backstage to put another string. And John or whoever was playing would take another instrument. It could be a banjo. It could be a guitar. It could be the wrong guitar.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's to do Nobody's Child. Well, Tony Sheridan and the Beatles did that as well. But lyrically, it's...
Absolutely. I met Tony Sheridan, and we had a long talk at One Beatle Week. I have Nobody's Child written out in front of my computer.
Oh, wow.
It's reminding me of how John felt, because, again, in those days, I don't suppose it would happen so much now, where the child is so much more the focal point of a family, but no one discussed anything with the child. John had to cope with this. And Tony Sheridan said to me, well, he told me a lot of things, actually, that I'm not going to say. But he said that was his song. And Rod Davis said he used to sit and play it. Wow. It's too sore to think about.
I'm nobody's child. I'm nobody's child. I'm like a flower just growing wild. Kisses and no daddy's smile. Nobody wants me. I'm nobody's child.
Tell me about a game you used to play called Swipe.
God, that was my father. He'd stand back to back and he'd hold your hands and pull you up so you were standing in front of him. And John was always warned not to do it. And he did. And I got such a smack on my head on the floor. And I had to go to bed with all the nice things that mothers bring, you know, when you go to bed, all nice drinks and everything. And John had to read to me. He had to come up and I could choose a book. And I chose the Mammoth Book of Fairy Tales and he read to me.
Bless. So what is the situation now? He's a teenager. He's in the Quarrymen. He's pretty well, Mimi's aware now that he's going.
Oh, she'd given up by this time. She couldn't do anything because when she was so strict, John just didn't go to school. Gone to secondary school then at 11. So he would get the bus to Penny Lane and get the bus down to ours, past Paul's house, to our house. The two estates were right next door to each other. Or he'd walk. But he came in his uniform and wasn't going to school. My mother said, he never said in my hearing, you've got to go to school. She'd go, oh, my dream's out. My dream's out.
I love that phrase. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, she said it all the time when she was happy.
Yeah. But it wasn't quite so easy often for you to go and see John at Mendip's, I guess.
No, we did go. When Mimi gave in, she gave in. And we'd all go. And then we all went over to Rock Ferry to Nanny's house. She had the big house. And that's, you've seen all those family photographs and they're in the books. They're everywhere. Mm. Well, they were mainly taken in Nanny's garden. By Stan and Uncle Norman.
Yeah. From what you can gather from your book, you really pick up all these different characters in the family. You wonder why John didn't have the strength to just say, look, Mimi, I'm moving in with Mum.
Well, I remember a particular row in the kitchen where he was going back after the school holidays and he was crying. And my father said, that's it. That's it. I've had enough. You stay here. I'll go and see Mimi. I will sort this out once and for all. And John said, no, I've got to go. Don't tell Mimi. That was another reframe. My dream's out. And don't tell Mimi. She was fearsome, I can tell you, fearsome.
Wow. We've mentioned it the last time we chatted. We won't go over it because I know you don't want to do it, but Mimi's secret is a particularly interesting part in the book. Yeah. People can
She had an affair, and all I said, Chris, was, it was the, hopefully, you've read the book three times, so maybe you can tell me. Hopefully, I didn't give in to any self-pity in the book. I tried to tell the story, and even when it is too sad for words, I tried to put it in some sort of surrounding context so that you can see, well, that's maybe why this happened, and how did they feel about that? And the only bit I allowed myself was Mimi. Really pathetic. Utterly, utterly pathetic. But in control of everybody. But the affair, yes, she was having the affair. He's still alive, so I can't say to him. But he was very, very open with me. Came to stay with me and told me far more than is in the book. And believe me, it was a raging love affair. That's all I can say. Went on for about 6 years. So I don't want to do anything detrimental outside the family, outside our own family.
Julia, 12 times 9.
108.
Very good.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
It's interesting that the narrative in so many books. I mean, I grew up in like the 80s reading all the famous books, and it's been a revelation reading yours, comparing those. But it's interesting that the narrative often tended to be that John became the rebel after you obviously lost your mum. But there's a few years later, I don't know if you saw it, went up for auction in 1955 and 1956, John's school detention sheets. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
I've seen a few things, yeah.
I'll send you photos of them.
Yeah.
But he's got lists of things he was put in detention for, which include silly noises in an examination, just no interest whatsoever,
yeah,
impudent answer to question, silliness, and sabotage.
You see, we didn't get that from him at home or in Mendix or in Rock Ferry, the big house, Manitoust. We didn't get that. He was obviously expressing himself as he could away from Mimi. I mean, I'm a teacher and then I worked with special needs. I've seen it all and I know what's happening. The place where they're out of the restrictions of whatever is screwing them up, they can express themselves better. It's not particularly good for anyone around them who doesn't understand what's really going on. All they see is the behaviour. But we know now, well, let's look behind this. What is going on here? What is happening here?
Yeah.
So, yes, he was, we all know he was a genius. I think that's a generally accepted thing. He wasn't stupid ever by any means. But he was, in my mind, basically saying what he thought about his life situation when all authority didn't allow him to say or do anything. But the biggest authority for John was at home in Mendix. So he could do something in school. Desperately sad. Too sad for words, isn't it? I've said that a couple of times now, but I look back and I think, oh, John... How do you explain that you live with your aunt when your mother lives around the corner? Oh, how do you explain that?
You used to go to Garston Market with your mother, and there was a time where she saw a guy selling the best genuine cowboy shirts outside America.
Yeah, that's right.
And she bought a few.
You've all seen those shirts on the Quarrymen at the Garden Fete, And Don's wearing his also at the Rosebery Street celebration for 750 years of Liverpool receiving the charter from King John. Although they got thrown off the lorry and police escorted to the bus stop, he was wearing it then. Yes, the Garston Market was an institution in wherever you're from. There will be a particular market that people try to go to on Saturday or something. And we had a couple of great big markets in and around Liverpool. Paddy's Market, famous in the road. Garston Market, very Catholic area, so everyone was there buying fish on Friday. That was the draw, that everybody bought fish on Friday. And we're not Catholic and we have fish on Friday. And then you'd be wandering up and down the markets and everything was for sale. Absolutely everything. And there'd be a runner, the fellow up at the top. He was almost like an auctioneer. He was so fast. But all the women knew what was going on. And anyone who showed the slightest interest, it would be like if you went to an auction and somebody who was experienced to say, don't do that, don't do that, don't blink because you bought it.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of thing. If you made any, you'd have the runners that come down with them in the hands and you know, a pound, yeah, only a penny to you. And it was great fun. We all loved going to the market.
But that was your first Quarrymen gig you saw, was it, I guess, at Rosebery Street?
Well, outside the kitchen.
Outside, as a performance.
They were only doing what we'd heard a couple of days ago. Yeah. There's nothing new. It's the first outside, yeah.
Walton Village Fete, you were there as well.
Yes, the whole family went because our lives were sort of ruled by the church in those days, whichever church you belonged to. Also, organised school as you got older, communion and communion preparation, and then you went to communion. And it was, but the church is very much a focal point of all our lives and outings, Easter outings, summer outings. They were organised by the church. So this one, at the Walton Fete, Pete Shotton's mother was on the church committee. And of course, Pete Shotton was in there with the old washboard. So Pete Shotton's mother convinced the church for the first time ever to have live music that wasn't Salvation Army. Salvation Army was there as well. They were on a makeshift, great platform. I can see them now, but don't ask me what they were singing, because I couldn't tell you. Because we all ran off to get candy floss and, you know, see the police horses and the police dogs running, jumping through hoops of fire and everything that happened. It was an exciting day. But we went as a family.
Yeah. Stuart McConey was on before and he said that day fascinates him because he's thinking, you know, you've got these people there looking at all the different stalls, looking at all the dog shows and whatnot. Not realising that in the corner over there, history is being made.
Is being made. It's, right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, absolutely right.
And you were there.
We were there. Yeah, for the whole day. And then in the evening, they did the community centre, St Peter's Community Centre, over the road where you had youth club and all that, which we all went to as well. And they met Paul at that place. And I believe, I've seen it written, I might have even said it in my book, that John thought Paul looked a bit like Elvis. Didn't.
You're a bit of an Elvis fan, aren't you? I've heard.
I'm an Elvis nutcase, yeah.
Do you think you got that from your mother?
Yes, we were well educated, all of us. When I go to Memphis, you know, people have said, because I'm not out there with the Beatles all the time, you know that. I mean, I'm not screaming and shouting it from the rooftops. I've been with the Pattern since 2004 and I've loved every minute of it. I do some work for Strawberry Field. It's because I choose to do it, but it's all low-key. It's all, it's not out there. It's not. So how do you put up with saying Beatle Week, the fans? Once you've been as an Elvis fan to Memphis, it's like the jigsaw. It's just, I get it now. I completely get it. We've done work with Jack Soden, Elvis Presley Enterprises. He runs the empire for Lisa Marie and Priscilla, I suppose. And we've had meetings in there, and it's beautiful. It could be King Arthur's table, you know, beautiful, big, not round, it's oval, but beautiful table. And the house is next door, and I can't think straight. I can't think, because I know it's an add-on. It wasn't there maybe when Elvis was alive, but I keep thinking, and I bet Elvis walked around here and you're really tall, so but I can't even concentrate. I'm better having that meeting somewhere else. And then I went in the house and I was floored, completely floored.
Yeah.
And I thought, I get this. I get it.
That's a relief. Paul was invited round. Your mother invited round because she heard about Paul's mum.
Yeah, and that poor boy. I remember saying, that poor boy. That poor boy.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then George joined the band. And it's astonishing. You forget how young he was. He was only 4 years older than you when he joined the band.
Yeah.
He's a kid.
He was very, very young, yeah. He could play B7. And he could play it on the top of a bus, no less. I mean, that's stardom, isn't it?
What are your memories of the three of them?
It's more, my memories are definitely, I mean, I remember George, of course I do, and we stayed with, we went to see him and Patty Boyd when we were in London in Weybridge, and they lived in Esher, and we all went to eat together. It was the first house I'd seen with no chairs, no cushions, because they were being hippies. But at home, it was always Paul, Rod Davis, Colin Hampton, Nigel. Anyone of that era is more who I remember in our house. I remember the people in the house because I wasn't out and about. I was too young to be out where they were, whereas Paul was always walking over. Mm. 5 minutes to walk from his house to ours. Wow.
5th of March 1958, your 11th birthday party. That was a bit of a shindig.
Crazy, crazy. Well, we had the whole class and then the teacher came as well to get their two daughters, and I remember him drinking tea in the kitchen with my mother and other adults, you know, because the adults would be drinking tea. It was a really, really good party, and I'm glad we had it. Really glad we had it.
People know the story. So, 15th of July 1958.
No, please, anyone can read the book to get all that. I don't want to go into any of that. I've got letters from everybody. Please, if you want to know more, you can actually read, not what I say merely, but what Paul says, what, you know, read it for yourselves, please.
12 times 11.
121.
Superb. But please do. It's called Imagine This, Growing Up With My Brother John Lennon. You can get it Amazon, I guess, or is it from your website?
No. JuliaBaird.co.uk, because I'll sign it for you. To you.
There you go. What was life like in the cottage compared with Springwood? So the cottage is basically...
Harry, my mother's...
Your new life.
Yeah, our new life, that's right. Well, again... from a mature point of view, an aging, old point of view. I'm serious. I can look back now and say, oh, my goodness. She went from Leela was her daughter, and she'd gone off to study medicine in Edinburgh. So she was only home for the holidays. But David, my cousin, was there. He's 10. I'm 11. Jackie's 8. So Harry tripled her family load overnight. Of course, when you're a child, you don't see it like that. But I see it now. I have said in my book, and it's almost quoting, that the sudden death of our mother almost ruined my sister and I. But there is always a silver lining. We got David. David has been the greatest gift for me. Yeah.
It was, I mean, John's reaction was obviously to hit the booze.
Yeah.
But another silver lining, he was, you know, art college, he met Cynthia Powell.
He did, yeah, he did.
It's fair to say he was besotted with her, wasn't he?
Utterly, absolutely besotted with her. She was achievement blonde for him. But geez, you look at pictures of Cynthia, that bone structure. If she'd have lived till she was 110, you couldn't take that away from her. It's built in, that's how her face was. She was beautiful inside and out, believe me. And she was very kind to Ducky and I when we did meet her. I kept in touch with her until she died. So she was... The last time we actually spoke was in just the beginning of October of the year before she died, because she died, I think, 1st of April next year. We talked for a couple of hours about absolutely everything. And again, must come and see you. You must come over, love. You must come over, love. Children, love, love. You must come over, love. And I did. I had actually been to Spain, where she lived.
Yeah, because John had similar issues. You know, the same sort of family. I think Mimi wasn't too keen. There's a theme running. It's that everybody seems to be protective, but not sure why they are.
No, not for the right reasons, maybe. Well, I remember I was in the room at one particular time at Mendips when Nanny Mater was down from Edinburgh on holiday, and Mimi and John, and it was not long before they got married. And obviously, they all knew that John was having a baby and that Cynthia was pregnant. And I remember them saying, "You don't have to marry her, John." So here was another baby about to be shunted away. And he said, "Don't you understand? I love her and we are getting married."
Wow.
Good for John.
Yeah.
Good for John.
It's, we're talking Hamburg era now. John's moved to Gambia Terrace, Stuart Sutcliffe. Did you meet Stuart?
Yeah. I didn't know him. Yes, I met him.
What memories do you have of him? Because we were talking the other day, there's no record of his voice anywhere. We only know him from pictures.
Well, what we hear mainly is he was a great artist, a la Picasso, but not very good at singing and playing. So maybe that's why. I don't know. But John was a good friend to him. It was a good friend, and John wanted him in the band, wanted him to come in. So the rest of it, you know, as fans, you would know as much as me. I didn't know Stuart as a person. I really didn't. Very good looking.
Well, yeah. Talk about cheekbones. I wouldn't mind those, blimey. It's 1962 onwards, really. I mean, the Beatles, they're the biggest band in Liverpool, then the UK, then the world. What impact did that have on you and Jackie's lives?
Well, we'd sort of grown up with it, hadn't we? Because we were very small in the kitchen, and my mother with instruments and then teaching John. And so it wasn't new to us. What was new that it wasn't going on in-house, it was going on outside the house. They were pretty determined to make it, weren't they? John particularly, John and Paul, because John was lined up to be a commercial artist as he did his foundation year, and then he was starting on the second year, and Paul would have gone to be an English teacher. So it isn't as if they had nothing in mind, but they must have sensed something, mustn't they? And as a team, I do call them the dream team, and there's nothing sarcastic about that. They together, individually, initially, obviously they made their own individual careers later when they had all that experience, practice, knowledge. But when they first came together as youngsters, they sort of fed off each other for it, didn't they? You can see them lying on the bed with school exercise book, you know, scribbling out and printing and rubbing out, and you can see it.
Yeah.
Screwing up bits of paper and saying, oh, that won't do, that won't do, and putting the tunes to the words. And they were the dream team. The essence of the Beatles has always been John and Paul.
Yeah. Bear with me, my cat's scratching at the door. Sorry.
Oh, go on. Go on. Go on.
I'm so sorry. Are you in or out? Oh, she's... And then she immediately wants to go out.
It's all right. We're cat people here. I guess it...
Didn't you had a cat called Elvis?
We did, and it had six kittens. It was an adopted stray. Picked it up in the street. I picked it up on the way to the shops. There's this tiny, tiny, tiny little cat. So we called it Elvis, and then it did have six kittens.
Wow. Anyway, sorry about that. So, yeah, inevitably, the Beatles' success got bigger and bigger. You're obviously going to see less of John. And obviously, sadly, you then lost your father in 65.
Yeah.
And again, there was a strange reaction when you returned to the cottage.
Yeah. Well, I can't say too much about that because the family's still there. But yes, if you read the book and you will see it there, I've recorded it, but it wasn't good. It wasn't good.
And the difficulty of actually physically contacting John throughout the, you know, Beatlemania era. But he eventually told you it wasn't that difficult at all, according to him, when he was saying you should have just turned up at Apple.
Yeah, well, it did. And the secretary said he hasn't got a sister. Oh, and I had Leela, my cousin, she's an anaesthetist, and I'd gone down to stay with her. She was actually living in the Beatles' flat in Sloane Street. And I went down to stay with her a lot. And we had a whale of a time, I can tell you. And I was looking after Robert, who was only 6 months old, baby. The other two children, Leela's other two children, were at school. She'd go off to the Royal ENT, where she was an anaesthetist doing her consultancy exams. And I looked after Robert in the day. So Leela had gone to work, taken the two children with her to go to the nearest primary school, to the Royal ENT. And I decided to go to Apple, so I did. So I walked in with the baby in the pram and was sharply shown the door. And later John said, oh, my God, I was upstairs. I was there. I am so sorry. I'm so sorry, Joe. I'm so sorry. I said, it's not your fault, but what sort of staff are you employing that don't even say, check this with them? Yeah. I said, run upstairs and just check. Tell him he's got a sister here.
That's probably why they got Alan Klein in. get rid of that receptionist.
Yeah. So I did make an attempt there. And then phoning him here.
Because obviously, you met your partner, Alan, and moved to Ireland. Or,
I did.
Belfast, wasn't it? So physically, it's going to be more difficult, I guess, to keep in touch.
It was. And John and I talked on the phone. He said, can you come over? I said, I can't. I'm really heavily pregnant, which was the case. So, yeah, we spoke then. And then, of course, I was going to say bedding in with Yoko. It's a pun on words. I didn't mean. And I was doing the same thing with Alan. We got married in Belfast. He was at Queen's University. And we had to stay there while he finished. And then we came back to Liverpool. Alan and I both came back to Liverpool to live. But that crossover time was when John then went to America.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, my cousin Stan saw him. Leela saw him. David saw him. All my cousins of the seven. But I didn't because I wasn't on the same piece of land. And in those days, you couldn't get on a plane with a great big tummy. They wouldn't let you on.
Mm. And then green card issues as well for John.
That's when he was already there. Yeah, when he was in the States. Yes, he had that. huge issue.
So in 1974, I think it was, it's weird, again, you were saying in the book, you discovered that John and Yoko had split up via reading it in the press.
I think the whole world knew it, didn't they? The whole world knew it split up and that May Pang was on the scene. And May was very concerned that John hadn't been in touch with his family in the UK, i.e. Jackie and I, and primarily, of course, Julian.
Mm.
And at that time, well, what happened then was that Cynthia did go over with Julian to see John in Los Angeles. So Julian was able to rebuild a relationship with his father when they weren't at that time in New York. So thank you, May. Thank you, May, is all I can say for that. And we also got, when he went back to New York, because they call it the lost weekend. I think it was almost 2 years, wasn't it? When he went back to New York, back to Dakota, he rang us. He rang Jackie and I and said, what can I do for you? And I'm really sorry about this. So, you know, he was apologetic about the rift. And he said, but let's sort of renew things. Let's move on. And I said, yeah, let's. And he asked me to describe the room I was in. And I'll tell you why he asked that. My mother used to, when she was drawing for us, used to draw, give us a piece of paper and say, let's do a room and where you'll put everything and where the windows would be and how big they would be. You know, you'd say, is it just going to be a living room? Is it going to be a bedroom? No, a room that you just absolutely have to live in. Apart from the bathroom, everything is in the room. We used to draw these rooms. Well, Don had that as well. He grew up with that. So what is your favourite room? Where do you like to be? And John said, describe the room you're in. And we both knew exactly what he was talking about. Another one, I'll just give you, before I go back to that, another example that my mother has sort of threaded through. We weren't allowed to eat ice cream, ever. I don't have it now. My mother used to say, it's Trex, which is just lard, fat. With sugar in it. We were allowed to have an orange made. So when the ice cream van came around, every child had an ice cream sandwich or a cone, or we had an orange made in the pictures anyway. And my children now would say, oh, mummy doesn't eat ice cream. No, my children doesn't eat ice cream. I can't stand the texture of it. Ooh, fat and sugar in it, which it probably is. Anyway, I was listening to something by Sean, and he said, oh, I don't eat ice cream. Dad wouldn't let me. See?
Really?
Right from my mother.
That's amazing.
Of course, Sean doesn't know that. Sean doesn't know that, but it's true. So this room, describe the room you're in. Now, Alan was a keen amateur photographer, and I bought him a Nikon app for his 21st. We had bought a Rolex from a journalist in Belfast. And then we had a Nikon, proper Nikon. And the bathroom was often turned into a drying room, you know, for negative. Mm. Yeah. And Harry, my aunt, said, these photographs, Alan, could you possibly do some of the family for me if I give you the little? He said, yeah. So we had all the photographs and he did them all. And I had some made for me as well, personally. And I had them around my house and I had a 20 by 16 of my mother. And it's the one that you all know, because there weren't many photographs in those days. You all know, my mother is pregnant with Ducky. You wouldn't know her, by the way. She was pregnant with Ducky. In those days, I was sitting in the garden with a silly frilly hat on and stuff. Tom was there, Leela was there, Sam took the photo. And there was one, a lovely one, of my mother with John. And I had Alan take John off it. I just wanted my mother. Mm. And he said, I haven't got anything. And he really didn't. This is the time when he was asking Mimi for the tie, the school tie, the clock, two-foot clock and everything. And he asked me, and I went down the next day. I took all the photographs down and sent them to him, and they've reappeared as Lenono. I take no notice of that, but they're all my family photographs that my ex-husband printed up, that Stanley and Uncle Norman took. So, and they've become marked, or whatever you call it, copyrighted. I mean, it happens everywhere with photos and images now, doesn't it? It's not just the Beatles industry. It happens absolutely. So there's John talking about the room, you know. So we just fell into easy talk straight away. And we spoke a lot. And then suddenly I couldn't get through.
You can read about this in the book. But there seemed to be, it just seemed to be, and also for Julian as well, he couldn't get hold of him.
Yeah, the same thing. We'd all been blocked. Blocked before blocking came. Cancelled before cancelling. We were the original cancellees.
Yeah, who knows? But let's skip over the 8th of December.
Plans
to come to the UK in 1981. I've heard there some were. Interviews yeah. with Jack Douglas and Andy Peebles, who were saying that the plans to record with Paul as well.
And I met Andy Peebles a few years ago before he died, and we had a long talk about it.
So, if people want to get hold of this, please do go to your website. I think it's an amazing book, and it fills in so many... It fills in tons of things. If you've seen the Get Back movie, you'll love the minutiae of all that tea, constant tea.
Yeah.
And it's silly things like that. And you get, and especially the Springwood stuff, I think it is so evocative, and it's really filled in so many holes. So I really do appreciate
you
coming on. One final question, and I think it's something all of our listeners would really love to know. 8 times 14.
Oh, my God. 414 to 64, so 128.
Julia Baird, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.